want us to think about the Lord's Supper as being three things. The Lord's Supper is a remembrance. We're going to think about the Lord's Supper as being a fulfillment and finally as a celebration. But particularly about that that remembrance. You maybe you're familiar with the Lord's Supper. You've heard it year after year. There's some people here this morning, I'm sure that they've probably been taking the Lord's Supper, maybe this evening, for over 60 or 70 years. And the amazing thing is that although it's so simple, God is always trying to reveal to us new things about what Jesus did on our behalf. So I want us to have a fresh look at that. But we start with what's most familiar. Normally when John leads it, he reads not from Matthew's gospel's account, but Paul's account. And of course, it's just a summary of everything that Jesus said that night. And so they all emphasize slightly different things as they try to summarize it. But as we think about this remembrance, this is the passage that he normally reads out. Jesus says in Paul's account, "Do this in remembrance of me." Took the cup afterwards and he said, "Do this in remembrance of me." Because Jesus wants us to remember everything that he had to endure so that we could be saved from our just fate. He is the one who had to experience our hell so that we could escape the hell that we deserve. So as a remembrance, we think of his betrayal. We think about his best friend had already, who he's having supper with, had already gone to the religious leaders at the time. And he'd taken 60 pieces of silver. He'd already agreed to hand him over, knowing that he would almost certainly be killed. And there he was eating with that man. And then there was his closest friend, his most trusted friend, Peter. And he turned around to Peter and he said, "Tonight you will deny me three times." Then, of course, there's the injustice that he received. Three Mickey Mouse kangaroo courts. First thing in the morning, hastily convened, people dragged out of bed just so that they could get this man executed as quickly as possible. Pilate, again and again, said, "I find no fault in this man. He is completely innocent, therefore take him out and have him whipped." What a perversion of justice is that? And despite the fact he knew he was innocent, he feared the crowd. He feared the religious leaders. He feared what Rome and what Caesar might think about him. And so just to appease everybody, he condemned a perfectly innocent man to death. Finally, we remember his sufferings. We remember those whips. We remember the temple guards who punched him in the face as they blindfolded him and mocked him and spat at him. We remember the crown of thorns that they were forced onto his head. We remember the whips that flayed his back open, blood poured out. We remember those cruel nails that were put through his hands and his feet, and the blood that was poured out. We remember for 3 hours he hung in agony on the cross until the heavens themselves were darkened at the shame of all that was happening. For 3 hours in darkness he hung there in agony until he breathed his last. And maybe you're thinking of next Sunday. Maybe you're thinking of Remembrance Sunday and you look back at the 20th century, the bloodiest century of all time. And you wonder, how could a good and loving God allow that? And you open the newspapers and you think, how could a good and loving God allow such injustice in the world? And then you think of your own experience where you've been betrayed, where someone who loved you stabbed you in the back. You think about the suffering that people that you've loved have gone through. Some of them have died. And you think, how could God allow all of this? And the cross is a reminder God, the eternal Son, suffered all of these things. God is not indifferent to betrayal, to your betrayal, to injustice, to suffering, because God himself experienced these things. And so we come to the Lord's table, sometimes almost sorrowfully, and rightly so, but with a deep, deep sense of gratitude that this is what Jesus was willing to do. But you know the beautiful thing about the Lord's Supper? It's not words. God addresses us with our senses. We can smell the elements. We can taste them. We can feel them. They're physical. We can see them. The words I've said move some of you, but God knows that they're not sufficient by themselves. And so he's given this multimedia presentation for us in the corner there for us to get more of him. And sometimes we hear these words better in a song. We understand more of what Christ. And for some of us, God will speak to us far more dramatically in a song. So I'm going to play us a song. I just want you to listen to it. I'll put the words up. Think carefully about the words and ask that God would speak to you through it.
Rudely in a stable shelter.
this world and face that fate so that we wouldn't have to, although we are the ones who deserve it. But really, how do we understand this? What happens on the cross? Well, God had been preparing the Jewish people for 2,000 years so that it should have been perfectly obvious what was happening. He gave such clear pictures of it. So really, to understand that, we've got to understand the Old Testament. We've got to understand something about how God was preparing his people, because the cross was a fulfillment. Think about that passage we looked at. It said, Jesus is talking, he's saying, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for the many for the forgiveness of sins." That word covenant, you can also use the word testament. You look at your Bibles and they're divided into the Old Testament and the New Testament. In the Old Testament, God was focused on the Jewish people and their mission to bring the glory of the Lord to the world. And in the New Testament, we see that fulfilled and the glory of God being spread across the world. But how was he preparing those people? Well, at the time of Jesus, you would see archaeologists have reconstructed what they think the temple looked like, and it probably looked very similar to this. Nice, clean, shiny surfaces everywhere, all very hygienic. Well, hardly. Because this was probably an awful lot like a third world cattle market. People brought their animals, their sheep, they brought their cows, they brought doves there. They brought them, I mean, let's face it, it was a dangerous place. It probably smelled horribly. And that temple, for want of a better word, was an abattoir. It's where people brought their animals to be butchered and sacrificed. If you go to one of the most neglected books of the Old Testament, it's pretty technical stuff, and it's a bit gross as well. Now, if there's any 10-year-old boys, you're going to love this part. If there's any squeamish vegetarians or vegans, I'm sorry, I'm just going to have to ask you to maybe turn your eyes away and maybe cover your ears. I don't want to offend you, but we need to understand what on earth was happening here. I mean, what's this doing in the Bible? This is from Leviticus. He, that's the high priest, the priest, shall remove all the fat from the bull of the sin offering, the fat that covers the inner parts that's connected to them, both the kidneys, with the fat that's connected to them near the loins, and the covering of the liver, which he will remove with the kidneys, just as the fat is removed from the ox sacrificed as a fellowship offering. Then the priest shall burn them on the altar of offering. I found this painting by Rembrandt, a famous artist. It's pretty gruesome, isn't it? Now, if you were to walk into the temple courtyards, you would have seen these slaughtered oxen lining and surrounding the whole of the courtyards. The idea was that a pious Jew would go to the temple, and he would go knowing that he is going to the Creator of all things. And he would look at his own life, and he would see all of his failings, all of the foolish and silly things and the wicked things that he'd done. And he would lay his hands on the head of the cattle, on the head of the ox. And the priest would come, and his assistants would probably bind the animal's feet so that it couldn't kick. And he would take an incredibly sharp knife, and he would slash the bull's throat. The bull would then be hoisted up so that the blood would immediately drain out of the animal, and within seconds, the animal would lose consciousness and die. As he saw that happen, that pious Jew was expected to know that God had accepted a substitute. What had happened to that ox deserved to happen to that man. But God had provided a substitute. And then the priest would butcher, probably in front of the penitent man coming up, probably in front of, he'd slash open the belly of the ox, and all its inwards would come out. And as we read there, those internal organs were then burnt on the altar. And that seems bizarre to us, until we start to understand a little bit more about how the Jews thought about themselves. You see, we, in our modern translations, don't want to confuse people because we don't think of ourselves like this in modern 21st century Europe. And so you'll find the word heart. My heart goes out, my heart's troubled within me. But in fact, if you look at the Hebrew, and even if you look at the King James Version, you come across these bizarre things like, my bowels were moved within me. Kind of makes us snigger nowadays. Or my liver is poured out. And you think about your own emotions. You think about when you're nervous before a test and you got butterflies in your stomach. You think about how awful it feels inside you, how your stomach churns within you when you've done something that you feel so ashamed of. Or even worse, when somebody has done something wicked to you and it just eats you up inside. That's the kind of language that was their everyday language for expressing their emotions. And the high priest would spill all of that out onto the ground. And that would be offered up to God. And that pious Jew would know that even all of that he could bring to God. It would be accepted on the altar. And you may have had horrible things happen to you. You may have done horrible things. You may feel so ashamed. And you may think, how could God ever accept all of this? And how could God ever take it all away from me? And God is giving you as clear a picture as possible that he's willing to take all of this and absorb it into himself. But not only that, there was this empty carcass left behind. And not everybody has all of these overwhelming feelings. You just feel a bit dead inside. Bit of a hollow, empty carcass. Sometimes you feel a little bit ticked off. Sometimes sort of mildly happy, but really there's just nothing going on there. And how could God accept that? We're supposed to be full of joy or despair over our sin or happiness and just go on day after day, just feeling a bit dead inside. And even that, God was willing to accept. Even this dead, empty carcass could be taken up to the altar and the whole thing could be burnt up and accepted to him. Of course, really what God was doing in the temple itself, he wanted to give people the clearest possible picture so that when they finally saw their Messiah, when they finally saw what was going to happen to him, they would understand exactly what was happening. They would understand the cross, that the Messiah himself would be the one that was the perfect substitute, the one that would take away all of their sins. And so God gave these incredibly vivid pictures and surrounded there. The book of Hebrews in the New Testament says that Christ appeared once for all at the end of the ages to do away with sin by the sacrifice of himself. Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many people because it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sin. You think about what Matthew said. What Matthew's account said of Jesus in the Last Supper. He said that this is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. And if you're not a Christian tonight and you want to understand what's at the core of our faith, it's the forgiveness of sins. And Jesus says this is done for many. And he invites you tonight to lay your hands upon him, that he would take away all of that junk or all of that emptiness that you feel within him. You can lay hold of him tonight, and he will absorb all of that into himself in that one perfect sacrifice, absolve you, accept you, and love you. Again, I'd like us to reflect on that in another song.
Not what my hands have done can save my guilty soul. Not what my toiling flesh has borne can make my spirit whole. Not what I feel or do can give me peace with God. Not all my prayers and sighs and tears can bear my awful load.
Do you live because Christ loves you? Do you love him because he first loved you? To know that love is the most delightful thing imaginable. To know that the holy God who demands the shedding of blood to atone for sin can love you so much. It's more powerful than anything you've ever imagined. If you're a Christian tonight, you can delight in that, in knowing that his love for you. If you're not a Christian, you can come to him and receive that love. And in the light of that, we have to remember that the Lord's Supper is also a celebration. Now, we don't normally come to the Lord's Supper with joy in our hearts, but that's perfectly legitimate because we are accepted by God. You know, one of the most amazing passages in the Old Testament is this, when Moses goes up the mountain. There's this thing called a fellowship offering. We talked about the sin offering already, but that wasn't the only type of offering that people could offer. They could bring their animal up as a fellowship offering. I'll explain what that means in a minute. But listen to this. Moses got up early the next morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain, Mount Sinai, and set up 12 stone pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. That's all that the people of God were at the time. He sent a young Israelite man, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls of a fellowship offerings to the Lord. Moses took half of the blood and sprinkled it in the bowls, and the other half he sprinkled on the altar. He took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, "This is the blood of the covenant." If you're familiar with the Lord's Supper, you remember that language, don't you? Jesus suddenly takes this fellowship offering and he applies that language to the Lord's Supper. That the Lord has made you in accordance with these words. Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel, representing all of Israel, went up the mountain, Mount Sinai, and they saw the God of Israel. Under his feet was something like a pavement made of sapphire, as clear as the sky itself. But God did not raise his hand against them. They saw God, and they ate and drank. The Jews had this ability to bring an offering up to God, and their sins had been dealt with. And suddenly they're inviting God round for a barbecue. Suddenly God is invited to share in a meal with them. This animal is butchered and slaughtered, and they are eating it as well, sitting round a table with God. Luke captures this, the joy that we can have as we come to the Lord's table, as he reminds us what Jesus said. You remember the parable of the prodigal son? This guy, he runs away from his father and he comes back having wasted his inheritance, and he knows that his father should reject him, and yet his father runs out to see him, and this is the attitude of his father. When the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fatted calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." And so they began to celebrate. The ultimate sign of their reconciliation, that they were that you are reconciled to God, is that you're invited to sit round his table. You're invited to eat with him. If you're a Christian tonight, God says to you this: "You are my child. I love you unconditionally as my child. I will never leave you nor forsake you. You are as precious to me as my eternal son, Jesus. I delight to have you in my presence, and I am filled with joy as you come to eat with me." And so of course we can come to the Lord's table with joy in our hearts. Remember what Jesus said: "I tell you, I will not drink from this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." Jesus is reigning in his Father's kingdom now. Jesus is saying to you now that he will drink from this cup that we drink from. He will be here tonight eating and drinking with us. That is a glorious cause for celebration. And if you're not a Christian tonight, that's something that I hope and pray that God will give you an intense desire for, because we would love to have you around this table, and you too can eat and drink with God.